Well, thank you very much for inviting me. My name is Gopolang. My name so I'm from South Africa, and my name in my home language means remember. So most people in the US never really remember my name, so just call it Gopi. And I'm very impressed by this pointer. It's very, very Canadian. It's hockey, and so I've actually never touched a hockey stick before. So this is a paper that I wrote about something that I've been fairly interested in recently, which is trying to explain the muon G-2 anomaly using inelastic dark matter. It's based on the FISREFD publication. So bear in mind that I'm going to try and make this a very interactive kind of elementary talk. And for those of you for whom this is too elementary, I must apologize in the beginning. So the current status, a brief review of the current status of particle physics, that we know that the standard model of particle physics has been very good in explaining much of the experimental data we see today. The recent observation of the Higgs boson has completed the standard model. However, we know that it is not the complete theory of the universe, and there are many hints that tell us this, including the usual culprits, which are dark matter. We know that the standard model does not explain dark energy. It doesn't tell us about the origin of neutrino masses, which we recently found were non-zero. It also doesn't tell us about the origin of electroweak symmetry breaking, among many other things. And so this tells us that there must be some new physics beyond the standard picture that we know. And both theorists and experimental communities are trying to work very hard to turn these hints into actual evidence. So how do we find new physics? New physics may show up in many different ways. We may look for what we call resonance or bump hunting, whereby in a collider environment, for instance, we can collide protons and look for some particle that produces that will decay into standard model particles. We reconstruct the invariant mass of these standard model particles and look for some signal of a bump at a very high significance above the background. The other way that we can look for this, in fact, this is the way that the standard model Higgs boson was found at the LHC. And I don't know if many of you remember, in 2015, there was this craze of the 750 GeV diboson resonance, which drove particle theorists crazy and then turned out to be a statistical fluctuation in the end. The other way that we can search for new physics is to look for what we call mono-X searches. You can look for collide particles in the collider, and then I have a missing energy and some X particle, standard model X particle, like a monophoton, mono Higgs, mono W, whatever other. And this is one way that we search for dark matter particles at the colliders. So on the opposite side of the spectrum, of the energy spectrum, we may look for new physics in precision measurements. And this may show up as deviations from standard model predicted processes, where at tree level, I could have a standard model couplings, that standard model particles that couple directly to each other. However, next to leading order, I may have some particles running in this loop here. Maybe standard model particles, and this is where some new physics particles may show up. And the prime example for this is to look for anomalous magnetic moments of leptons. And not only is this a way that we can search for new physics, however, it also can be a precision test of the standard model, in the sense that if the standard model predicts a certain rate for this process, and it shows up exactly as that in experiments, then we know that the standard model is very good at that prediction. So the outline of this talk is, I'm going to discuss The outline for this talk is that I'm going to discuss how the precision frontier could help us uncover new physics by looking precisely at the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon. I'm going to also talk about the ongoing efforts, just briefly describe the ongoing efforts from both the theory and experiment community, just to put everything in context, and talk about my contribution to the inelastic dark matter contribution to the muon G-2, give some brief results and conclusions on future work. So just a very quick recap is that we know that if we put a spinning charged particle in a uniform magnetic field, it induces a dipole magnetic moment. This dipole magnetic moment we usually measure as mu L here being the lepton. There's a gyromagnetic factor, the charge, the mass, and the spin of this particle. And from the Dirac equation, a three-level coupling here induces a G, a factor of 2. Only at next to leading order, we start having deviations of G from 2, and this is where the anomalous part of the dipole moment comes in. This is G minus 2, it's defined as G minus 2 over 2. And so for the electron, it turns out actually the electron G minus 2 is one of the most accurately verified predictions in this nature today, not only in particle physics, but in all of nature. Because the theory calculation was done to 10th order, so 5-loop level, with all these very complicated diagrams. And the experimental measure was done at Harvard using a cylindrical pinning trap. And they found the value, the original deviation from between a standard model experiment and theory was about a difference of minus 1.8 sigma. And recently, measurements of atomic cesium were used to determine a more precise value of alpha, which is the leading contribution to this theory calculation. It shifted the standard model theory calculation a bit, and it moved it from minus 1.8 sigma to minus 2.3 sigma discrepancy. And so right now still, we could say, well, it moved from minus 1.8 sigma to 2.3 sigma, but it's still, 2.3 sigma, it doesn't really tell us anything. It's still kind of a standard model prediction. Then moving on to the muon, as precise as the electron G minus 2 is, new physics effects are more likely to show up in the muon G minus 2 than in the electron G minus 2. Purely because of the mass difference between the muon and the electron. And then by that, I mean 40,000 times because if I look at these next to leading order diagrams, the ratio between these goes as the mass of the electron squared over the mass of the muon squared, which is just 1/40,000. And then on top of that, muons are relatively easy to produce. Well, not as easy as electrons, but they're relatively easy to produce. They're also perfect for studying anomalous magnetic moments and also for precision tests of the standard model. So the muon, G minus 2, was measured at the BNL EA21 experiment and was measured to 0.4 parts per million. So they were looking at the most precise measurement. The theory calculation was also done, and they looked at, compared these number. Now you see a difference here at about ninth decimal place, I think. And so they compared these at the ninth decimal place, and they found that the difference between the experimental measure and the standard model measure was about 3.3 to 3.6 sigma discrepancy. Now this is where particle physicists and cosmologists, 2 sigma is really nothing to write home about, but 3 sigma is then where we start really questioning everything. Is it, a theory calculation problem? Is it that we understand our experimental apparatus very well? So where does this discrepancy come from? So it turned out, actually, that they realized that the BNL...
Is it really 40,000 times bigger than the other one, this number?
The muon?
No, I mean the anomaly. I guess because you're saying it should go as mass to the fourth... Sorry, mass to the square, right?
Yeah, it just goes as a ratio of the mass squared.
So this is like 2 times 10 to the minus 9, and the other one was...
It's not 40,000. It's not 40. I mean, it's that discrepancy 40,000 times.
Compared to electrons, was 10 to the minus 14, wasn't it?
No, no, but it's not. I don't think it scales that way.
It doesn't. So how would it scale?
So, but then, I mean, like, in order for it to scale that way, you would have to be sure that you have the correct experimental measurement and the correct theoretical calculation. And this is where I was getting to.
Okay.
So because what we're saying is that in a perfect sense, the muon is supposed to have more new physics effects than the electron.
But right? I was thinking, but you're talking about like mass divided by cutoff squared or something like
that. No, I'm just talking about the ratio of the mass squared.
No, but I mean, this should be zero in the standard model, right? So the only reason it wouldn't be zero is that if there is new physics, that's some high energy.
Wait, when you say zero, you mean the delta mu?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. So it should be zero.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's not zero, that means there's some new physics somewhere. And assuming it's at high energy, presumably this would go as mass divided by cutoff squared.
Okay.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I assume that was the reason that you said for muon it would be bigger than electron, because muon mass is 200 times bigger, so it's square that is 40,000. So that, does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. But then again, I mean, you know, the sigma, I don't think you can just, you know, take that 40,000 into this sigma calculation, because this again has a lot of uncertainty in it.
So there's a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, there's a lot of experimental and theoretical uncertainty. Okay. So in a case where we have the most precise measurement and the most precise standard model calculation, then maybe it comes out to be the 40,000 as you're saying.
The point is that because of this mass scaling, the sensitivity of the loops to higher mass particles goes up to TeV.
Yeah.
It's much lower for the electron.
That's what I'm saying, right? Yeah.
That's the reason for the significance of this.
I mean, uncertainties would be in errors. That wouldn't be in there. So, I mean, the errors presumably capture the uncertainties, don't they? So, the mean, you would think this should be 40,000 bigger than the one for the electron.
No, it's higher energy. It's all to do with loops.
Right.
Especially hydraulic. So you go to TV looking for new particles.
Okay, so let's see what happens next. But okay.
By the way, one sigma more than 2.5 sigma is, does that excite us?
It's sorry?
The discrepancy in the electron is 2.5 sigma.
Mm-hmm.
This is one sigma more.
It's actually but the electron one is in the negative direction. It's negative 2.5 sigma.
That's not good. Okay.
Yeah.
No, it's bigger.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but I mean, so the electron, the electron discrepancy is negative 2.3 sigma, whereas the muon is positive 3.6. Yeah. So it's much. It is actually much, much bigger. Anyway, so as I was mentioning, it turns out that the BNL experiment is not very good at producing muons, so they have to, instead of building a whole new experiment, which will cost money and take more time, they decided to take the entire storage ring and shift it to Fermilab, where they would actually produce a lot of muons. And so instead of them actually moving from Long Island all the way across the country there, they moved the entire thing through on a ship and put it up the Mississippi River. Well, if any of you have been to Long Island, New York, you know that people are not very happy already in the traffic. And imagine you have this huge thing traveling at 2 miles an hour on the roads. That will create a lot of chaos. So it was actually a big a celebration when they saw this this huge G-minus 2 ring that came at Fermilab. And so now I'll discuss a little bit about the ongoing efforts in particle in this direction. So the Fermilab E99 experiment, which uses this G-minus 2 ring, is currently running at Fermilab. As far as I know, when speaking to the experimentalists in the group, they have run 1 data already taken. They have they're finishing up run 2, and they are starting up run 3. And in the end, they want to reduce the statistical uncertainties from the BNLA21 experiment by a factor of 4. The JPARC experiment in Japan is scheduled also to run at some point in the near future. They will use a different experimental setup, but it will be a reproducibility experiment to try, to reduce this by a factor of 4 as well. On the standard model, I was really. When I saw this little cartoon, I was very happy because it helps me understand the G-minus 2 experiment a little bit better. Not as sophisticated as the experimentalists themselves, but the idea basically is that you shoot a beam of muons into this storage ring that has about a 2 Tesla magnetic field. You accelerate these muons and you measure their precession rate compared to their momentum. So if they move the same, if they spin the same rate as they're moving, G you extract to be 2. If they spin faster than they're moving, then G factor is expected to be larger than 2. And the anomalous part then can help us determine how much larger G is from 2. And so from the theory side, we may ask the question, have we included all the standard model contributions, or do we understand all the uncertainties? So the contributions from the standard model theory come from the QED diagram, where we exchange a photon there. We have also contributions from the electroweak, where we have the WZ and the Higgs boson contributions, and we also have these QCD contributions. Now, it is claimed that the QED and electroweak contributions are very well known. They've been calculated at two-loop level, and we cannot calculate them more precisely than this. The biggest problem comes from the QCD contributions, where we had the hadronic vacuum polarization diagram and the hadronic light-by-light scattering. And so these are all non-perturbative QCD calculations, which require lattice QCD and dispersion relation measurements. So measurements from Babar, which give us dispersion measurement relations, would work in parallel with the lattice QCD in order to determine these very, very precisely. And so there's a lot of work being done in this direction.
Got to this. Apparently, the lattice QCD calculations have rather large uncertainties.
Yeah, they still have a very large uncertainties. Yeah.
Depending on E plus, E minus, eta.
Yeah, so they're actually checking each other. So actually there was a meeting last week at Brookhaven, a lattice meeting, where they were looking at also the current results for the G minus 2 calculations. And so they always work in tandem, as my understanding is that they always work in tandem with the E plus E minus data relation people.
Because it's always been a suspicion that the hadronics part is quite complicated.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't be surprising if there was an error in summing up all these loops for the hadronic. That could be the culprit.
Yeah. Yeah, so and from what I can tell, my friends who work on lattice QCD, they said that the biggest contribution actually comes from the hadronic vacuum polarization. It's more dominant than the light-by-light scattering, and they claim to be making the most progress in this field, but I'm not a lattice QCD person, so I have no idea. So what this all means is that, you know, as a particle phenomenologist, I like to be very optimistic. Is that if, for instance, the experimental measure, the central value remains the same, and the theory measure, the theory calculation, the central value remains the same, but we reduce these uncertainties, with this could move from a 3 to 4 sigma discrepancy to more than 5 sigmas, and in this case, you know, that's when we pop the champagne bottle. Oh, maybe not yet, but we actually then say we're clear that this must be new physics that contributes to this. So what new physics could contribute to this muon G minus 2 discrepancy? There are many examples out there. A lot of people have looked at supersymmetry, having superparticles running in that loop. A lot of people have looked at axion-like particles that can explain this. They're like extra Higgs particles at the TeV scale that could be running in that loop that could explain this. But for the purpose of today, I'm going to be talking about the dark photon. We're going to be focusing more on the dark photon explanation. So this is a massive gauge boson in the U1 prime extension of the Sunner model, which I'm sure you all know. The Lagrangian after electroweak symmetry breaking and gauge kinetic turn renormalization goes as the mass of the dark photon, and it's coupling to the dark sector fermions. I assume that some dark sector fermions are there, and it couples through this kinetic mixing term with the standard model fermions. And its contribution to the G minus 2 was first for a kinetically mixing dark photon was actually first worked on by Maxim Pospelov, who I'm sure you all know as well. And the loop contribution goes as this epsilon squared over the mass of the dark photon squared. And as I mentioned here, that there's coupling to the dark sector. Here, this is not supposed to be a mistake, by the way. This is supposed to indicate invisible. This is also a coupling to the visible sector.
Sorry, I don't want to take wind out of your sails. I'm not against dark photons. I'm just wondering, is the only reason for focusing on that is because we're interested in dark photons, or are dark photons prefer, like you could put a dark scalar, you could put it.
You can put it whatever you want.
So it's just you like dark photons, you want to see how far.
And I will show why I'm interested in the dark photon.
Okay.
Yeah. So if the dark photon or some dark vector, you can call it whatever you like, so but some dark vector particle is responsible for G minus 2, then we can search for it and look at how it decays in our experiments. So if it decays visibly, And couples to the visible sector, then it can you can produce it. It decays into, say, for instance, E plus E minus through this visible decay. This idea was then explored further by experimentalists who searched for this at the Babai experiment, where they looked for E plus E minus to a photon and a dark photon. The dark photon decays into E plus E minus back, and they looked for this resonant decay of the dark photon. So Babai found no evidence for dark photons in this region of parameter space. So this line here, the central value, is the value that explains G minus 2, and this 2 sigma allowed region around that central value.
So this is the muon G minus 2, right?
It's the muon G minus 2.
You don't care about electron G
minus 2? Nope. Because we assume that the electron G minus 2 is so precise, we actually use it as an exclusion bound. So we're saying that anything, any physics, or any new physics that contributes to the electron G minus 2 should be excluded above that region. And then people thought that, well, there's this little sliver of space here that's left there. NA48 went and completely ruled that out as well. So for a dark photon decaying visibly, this has been ruled out for explaining muon G minus 2 anomaly. However, it can also couple to the invisible sector through this G dark coupling. And this idea was also explored at experiments where Babai, again, most recently in 2017, looked for this decay signature where it's E plus E minus to a photon and a missing energy, a missing ET. And they looked for this and they didn't see anything in this region of parameter space, so they rule out this whole region of space. NA64, which is a fixed target experiment, they shoot a beam of electrons at a fixed target and they put a detector right behind this fixed target. And then they look for, they can measure the momentum of the electrons before and after in their detector. And any if the electrons have lost energy and they don't see any other particles in the detector, then there must be some particles that took this momentum away. And so they look for a dark photon in this region. And again, they rule out this part of the parameter space. So unfortunately, for visible and invisible decays, the dark photon has been ruled out for explaining muon G minus 2. That's my talk. Thank you. Anyway, so we may question, however, the dark sector model building in principle. So the dark sector is unknown, as we you know, well, it's a known unknown. So why should the dark photon couple so simplistically to a dark sector? The standard model is not very simple. So let's look back at the model, the dark sector model building. In the dark sector model building, I can look at the mass term in the Lagrangian. I have a direct mass for these dark sector fermions. If I require a charge 2 Higgs, a dark sector Higgs here, then I had to have this Yukawa term. So this Yukawa coupling times when the Higgs gets a VeV, then I have this kind of Majorana mass term here. If my Yukawa term is 0 or much, much, much smaller compared to the direct term, then when I diagonalize from the gauge to the mass basis, I have diagonal couplings giving me a chi and a chi bar coupling to this dark photon, which then we know is an invisible decay that has been ruled out by these experiments. However, if this Majorana is small compared to Dirac, but not so small, it's somewhat sizable, then I could have an inelastic coupling, meaning that when I diagonalize from the gauge basis to the mass basis, I have off-diagonal couplings, which give me this inelastic scattering, or this inelastic coupling to the dark photon. And so I would have a chi 1 and a chi 2 state. These are related by a mass splitting delta, which is M2 minus M1. So when I create this dark photon in the detector, it would decay into chi 1 and a chi 2. Chi 2 is a heavy state, which can also subsequently decay, giving me different signatures inside my detector. And this is what I call a semi-visible decay mode. So if chi 2 decays inside the detector, it decays into soft displaced leptons, which then would show up inside my detector, which would weaken all the any of the invisibly decaying dark photon bonds. And so, so I revisited this idea of an invisibly decaying dark photon And I asked the question, well, with a semi-visible decay, can this explain, can we still explain the G minus two in this dark photon model? And this is precisely why I wanted to focus on the dark photon, because of these bounds, and seeing if I can revisit this idea for these. Now, it's fair that you could look for this also at with scalars. I mean, invisible particles are invisible. It doesn't really matter what they are in this case. And so here, this is just the bound from Babar. And here I chose nominal couplings of for this mass splitting of about 0.4 times the mass of chi1. I chose the mass of A prime to be 3 times the mass of chi1, and this alpha dark coupling to be somewhat strong. And so if we focus mostly on the Babar region here, because Babar looks for purely invisible decays, they look for monophoton signature. If chi2 decays inside the detector, they would actually veto these events. If they see any lepton events inside the detector, they veto these. And so, however, for this, what I did was I looked at the fact that the decay width of chi2 goes as a delta to the power 5. So for large mass splittings, this particle can decay inside the detector, which would weaken the Babar limits in this case. And the significance of this is that I'm actually opening up the parameter space in this region here. So in this region of space, the dark photon can still explain the muon G minus 2 anomaly.
Sorry, which region are we looking at?
Yeah.
Over here. So this is the white region. So everything that is colored here is all ruled out. Yeah, I'm sorry, these it's very hard to plot these, put these plots with so many colors and stuff, and I'll show later what I do to kind of counteract this. So
the relic abundance, that's just to have the right amount of dark matter in the universe,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay.
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about this in a bit here, so. So for the focus of this, it's just to, we should focus on the Babar bond, which is actually the most strongest bond. And there's this also K to pi nu, which in this doesn't, there's no signal that could cause a background in this, because I required decay into invisible and displaced leptons. Whereas here it's just the K to pi plus some invisible particles.
So what are the three parameters here? So you have, I guess, the mass of the dark photon, the masses of this M chi 1,
mm-hmm.
and delta is the gap.
It's the mass splitting between chi 2 and chi 1.
So there are three free parameters, and then there's the epsilon and alpha d.
Yeah.
What's epsilon again?
So epsilon is the kinetic mixing. So it's the term that couples the dark sector to the standard model.
What is the mass of
Mass of the dark photon is here. So I'm plotting mass of the dark photon as a function of epsilon. So the mass of the dark photon that is still available, it's roughly 1 GeV.
So it's pretty heavy.
Yeah, you could argue that.
Surprising that such a heavy object has not been seen in the last 100 years.
But if the mixing is as small, then it's dark.
It's dark, you can't see it.
So, why do you tweak those parameters? I mean, this.
So the whole point actually, yeah, to show that, actually, thanks for that question. The whole point is to show, so for instance, let's say I choose a splitting of 0.1, for instance. 0.1, I show actually, I'll see that this Babar region does not change very much. For 0.1 mass splitting, the chi2 is still very long-lived, so it will decay outside my detector. That just looks like a monophoton signature. So for very large splittings, it shows me that the chi2 particle decays inside my detector. And so then what Babar thinks is a monophoton signature is actually not. It's leptons that are decaying inside the detector. And this is why I choose such large splittings.
And what was alpha d? Sorry, I just put it in.
So alpha d is the g dark squared over 4 pi.
Yeah, I just want, so again, to return, I mean, so dark photons between 500 MeV and a GeV are permitted, basically.
Yeah.
Right? So what if you just said, I don't care about a dark photon, just a dark scalar with Yukawa, is it comparable?
I haven't looked at that, but actually that's one thing I'm going to look at. The one thing I worry about is the, in principle, you're right, it could be comparable, but I think I worry about the relic abundance, which I'll show later why that's the case. And Yeah, I haven't actually looked at that in detail, but yeah, it is possible that you could have this. Yeah. So it's not it's not necessarily just the photon, the dark photon is so special. I was just using this as a case to point out.
Does this dark photon decay into what? Anything in the standard? Like what does it couple to again in the standard model?
So it couples to, in the standard model, it couples to all the standard model fermions. So quarks, leptons.
FFR.
Yeah.
That's lighter than it is. That's
lighter than it is, yeah.
Does it need to couple in a vector-like way to contribute to the G minus two, or can it put a scale over time?
So yeah, a scalar could work as well. If you have some scalar that has Sayukawa to the couplings to this, or mixing with that mixes with the Higgs, and it gives you a coupling to this dark sector fermions, it could give you the same thing. As I said, I'm using the dark photon as a case here to point out that this decay is possible.
So, a lot of effort, as we like to say, every year has gone into detecting U1 particles, so-called Z primes, which are dark photons with a mass. I mean, they're not dark. They're massive photons, so to speak. And they look for missing transverse energy. And they see nothing in that energy range.
In this energy range? As far as I know, they haven't looked below 1 GeV. As far as I understand, the only things that we have now are projections from CMS and Atlas. They have been looking at like 10 GeV and above. The problem with the below 1 GeV is that you have all these hadronic resonances, and you have all these you have a large Drellian background, which would completely drown out the signal. And most of these signals are looking for, or most of these searches are looking for dark photon decaying into E plus E minus. So how do you see an E plus E minus resonance in a large Drellian background? It's hard to do.
That's why we need a new E plus E minus combiner.
Yeah. So Bell 2 is actually a good candidate for this. Does that answer your questions? Yeah. So in principle, you're right. That's something that I'm actually thinking about for my next study, which I'll talk a little bit about later. In any case, so how we can search for the signal is we can look at proton beam dumps. So at a proton beam dump, we collide a beam of protons on a fixed target. This proton beam dumps are usually neutrino experiments, current neutrino experiments. You collide a beam of protons on a fixed target. Out comes mesons, some neutral and charged mesons like pions. So the charged pions would give off neutrinos, but the neutral pions give off two photons. We use this in principle. A neutral pion can give off a photon and a dark photon. The dark photon decays into chi1, chi2. Chi1 can travel to the detector, scatter off inside my detector, and I can see the signal for that. Or if chi2 is long-lived enough, it can also travel a few hundred meters down to the detector and decay inside the detector. So this would be the decay signature and a scattering signature. I could also produce a dark photon through dark bremsstrahlung. So a proton would radiate off a dark photon in this case, and I could have that dark photon decaying into chi1 and chi2 in that sense. So current experiments that have been there to look at LSND and Mini Boon for this. And Maxim Pospilov has actually done a lot of work in this direction. I can look at electron beam dumps as well. So similar to the proton fixed target, an electron fixed target could work in a similar way, where I do through dark bremsstrahlung, I produce a dark photon, it decays into chi1, chi2, and I could have a scattering signature in this way, and I could have a decay signature inside my detector. E137 at SLAC was an experiment to look at for this. And there's also the BDX experiment, which should be built at JLab either next year or in the next 2 years.
Where is
JLab? In Virginia. It's Jefferson Lab, Virginia. I can also have signatures and missing momentum, as I mentioned before, Na64, where I collide a beam of electrons at a fixed target, and instead of putting the detector maybe 400 meters away, I put it right behind this target, and I can measure I can track very well the electron momentum. If anything else comes out of here, the momentum of the electron would be smaller, and I produce the dark photon that decays either inside the detector or outside this detector, and search for this. So NA64 is one at CERN, and LDMX is also a concept experiment which should be built at some point somewhere. I don't know. You know. Well, I shouldn't say it should be built, but people would like it to be built at some point somewhere. Signatures at B factories. I've talked about Baba and Bell too. So we collide electron positron into dark photon and a photon. Dark photon decays into chi1, chi2. And if the chi2 decays inside the detector, then I could see this through this displaced lepton signature that I had mentioned before. And so since this is a dark sector model, we also mentioned about the dark matter. We know that we have a lot of evidence for that dark matter exists. We have rotational velocities of galaxies tell us that our galaxies are surrounded by dark matter halos. There's a gravitational lensing that tell us that there's some unobserved mass that lenses objects distant galaxies. And the most convincing evidence would come from the CMB spectrum. So this is a plot that I stole from Sean Carroll's blog, where it shows the data from WMAP and fits to two different models. So this is a MOND and this is a dark matter model, and it shows that this peak here, which tells us about how much dark matter there is in the universe, is actually fit very well by the dark matter lambda CDM model. So there are a lot of other evidences for the existence of dark matter. We know that the standard model does not tell us anything about dark matter, but this inelastic dark matter dark sector model does. So chi2 in principle is long-lived and can be a thermal relic particle whose relic abundance is set by co-annihilation. So chi1, chi2 through this A prime goes into the standard model. Annihilation actually here would be ruled out by the CMB measurements for the mass ranges that I'm talking about. But co-annihilation evades those bounds. There's also downscattering. So if a chi2 is produced in the early universe in this thermal bath, it would decay. It would downscatter with the thermal bath into chi1, setting the relic abundance, and also decay of this chi2 into chi1 and the standard model, reheating the standard model bath. So the results of this is, again, in this region of parameter space. So the blue line is this E137 scatter, this electron beam dump results, which rules out this part of the parameter space. And E137 decay rules out this part of the parameter space, again, for the same parameters, benchmark parameters that I chose. Now, in order to see this better, I just put all these current constraints in just gray. So everything in this gray region is ruled out. And then these are the projections for Baba. So the claim here is that this signal could, in principle, exist already in Baba data. All they have to do is just reanalyze their data from looking for monophoton signature to looking for very low energy leptons inside their data. And so this is just a Baba displaced signature for that, for just reanalyzing the data. And we see that it covers this region of parameter space. Now, the interesting thing is that this relic abundance line actually overlaps quite well, different change in parameters. It actually overlaps quite well with this G-2 line. So this model actually explains G-2 and, well, could explain G-2 and can explain the thermal dark matter relic abundance in the universe, and also gives us a new signature to actually go and search for in the near future with current experiments. And so Bell-2 with a monophoton signature, a monophoton trigger, so Bell-2 is currently running, I think, but they have their future in 2025, they would have in 50 inverse attobonds of data. So they will be the most sensitive E plus E minus collider. And in principle, they could search for the signal in this region better than the LHC can, for instance.
Sorry, so the relic abundance, to explain it, you have to be on that line, above that line?
You have to be on this line.
On
exactly
that
line. On that line, yeah.
So they just sort of touch
each other, which It's nice coincidence. When I made this at first, I was like, I realized, and this is another reason I choose these values, because it gives us a really great coincidence why this is.
But that's cheating. You pick the values, brother. If you change the values, this coincide.
And then they don't coincide. But then it makes a case for it. It makes a really good great case for this, because if I say that this is the, I tell experimentalists that look, this is, you can go search for this in this region, the signal in this region, and they find something. This not only could explain this G-2 resonance, but it could tell us about the dark matter or the dark sector modeling in the universe, in principle.
I appreciate that. And just the question is, if you, I mean, you have an entire region of parameters.
That is true.
Three free parameters.
Yeah, and I'm going to show a different plot in a little bit. Okay. And so we see that the Babar display signature actually would be able to probe this region. So with the data that's already there, if experimentalists went in and did this reanalysis, they could actually find a signal or rule this out. And we learn a lot. We would learn a lot about this kind of model.
I guess that's the builder rule of that, if the parameters are different or not.
Well, they would rule out this part of the parameter space.
But then
maybe there's some other thing. But again, then becomes kind of, my intuition is that it becomes kind of a weaker case at that point, because, you know, fine, I could still explain the muon G-2, but I don't know. Becomes a little weaker.
Is the only part of the parameter space where the relic abundance and G-2?
It's actually not. I'll show you another picture. Actually, this is the point. The other way that I could ask this is how, for what values of the mass splitting can I still explain the muon G-2 parameter, the muon G-2 line? And for this, I look at the plot delta over MKI1 versus MKI1. And I see that for delta of 0.6, this is when I can explain G-2 and relic abundance very well. And so this is the region, well, for that, but only what this is going to do, changing alpha dark, actually just shifts this down or up. It just rescales that relic line. And so for nominal couplings here, I'm actually then, I can find, or I can explain G-2 and the thermal relic abundance very well. And so the plans for future work is I would like to probe this parameter space even further at other experiments. The experiments that I would like to look at is Bell, Bell 2, and I started talking to experimentalists about this at JLab and also people working on PADME. I like to look at also Miniboon, which is a proton beamed up at Fermilab, NOVA, NA64, and NA62. The future projections are LDMX, BDX, and Sequest, and all these other long-lived particle searches. And also scalar dark matter or scalar mediators, as you've mentioned, these are also something to look at as well. My intuition is that they won't be too different from the dark photon, but they also deserve to be looked at as well. And so, in summary, the hope I've shown you today, I've discussed a little bit that leptonic moments can be good probes of new physics if we have a good handle on our theory and experimental uncertainties. The dark photon coupling elastically to dark fermions and to the standard model is robustly ruled out for explaining G-2. And the dark photon, this dark photon model, this dark sector model explains three things. It gives me the relic abundance simultaneously with explaining muon G-2, and it gives me a new signature to go and search for in the detectors. So one way to rule this out is to say, I'm going to my detectors, I don't see anything, so maybe this model doesn't exist. The study, why I'm interested in the study currently is that it's time appropriate because the G-2 data is currently coming up. In the next few years, G-2 experiments are going to have their data, and the theory guys will have their calculations well. So we might actually see a 5 sigma discrepancy between these, which would be a good probe for new physics. And thank you.
Ultralight A prime.
You would need your couplings to be very, very large. Well, no, sorry, the other way around. You need your couplings to be low. If I'm not mistaken, I'm actually not sure what the how low the couplings would need to be, but in principle it could work. But I'm worried about the other proton beam dumper constraints at very low masses of these ultralight particles, and then there are other like supernova constraints which could constrain these that model in that region.
I can see ultralight dark matter is becoming popular.
Yeah.
So. Put in the A prime. If you lower the coupling constant, it's weakly interacting anyway.
It's very weakly interacting, but it's also the dark photon then is also very long lived in that case, so which could create some problems in the early universe as well.
What problems?
So hidden sector couplings. So you would, as far as I understand, you don't want your dark matter to, or so if you have a secluded annihilation of the dark matter into dark photons, if these are very, very long lived, it creates problems with the relic abundance. I'm not 100% sure why, but it people claim that it does.
I see dark matter is popular.
It's very small, yeah.
It's a wide open game.
It is, yeah. But then there aren't only the relic abundance constraints. There are other constraints from supernovae and proton beam dumps and stuff, which would be the worry. But then you could also lower the coupling constant much, much lower than that. But yeah, it's something that can be in principle. Could be gravity, okay. Yeah. And then I'll come back to you.
So what are the dominant, you mentioned in the beginning that there are these hadronic contributions to G minus 2 and that you need to do lattice computations in order to extract them. Is there a systematic there that people worry about? And does anyone argue that it's plausible that that systematic could be large enough to come even close to explaining the discrepancy?
I think there is a systematic, yes. It mostly comes from the hadronic vacuum polarization, from my understanding. But it also has to do with the lattice spacing that they choose, the computational time. So each lattice group has their own configurations, and they all argue among themselves. And this is why they always refer to the R-ratio data to get a better handle on what the correct calculation is. But I don't think the systematic is enough to actually explain this discrepancy, but I'm not 100% sure about this.
So, what would be the prediction for electron? For electron, you might.
So you would need. You would need a. So actually, Human WSL wrote a paper with Bill Marciano recently that explains both discrepancies. So. They explain that you have a scalar that couples so you have some dark scalar that couples to the standard model, so to both electrons and muons, and up to two loop level, it can explain both the electron G minus two in the negative direction and the muon G minus two in the positive direction. The other people who've looked at supersymmetry, they can explain both.
Just this model that you discussed. If I just calculate G minus two for electron, what do you get?
You won't get anything that explains. It only goes in the positive direction.
Okay, so but it would be too big or too small.
It's too big.
So then what? I mean, then the model would be ruled out already, or?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, there are certain parts of the model. So there are certain parts of the model, like in this region of parameter space here. This is where this would be ruled out.
But larger masses it wouldn't be.
No. Yeah.
Okay.
But can't you just adjust the coupling of this thing to the electron to make it negligible anyway? In principle, every particle could have its own dark charge.
In principle, yes.
So just give the electron a tiny dark charge compared to the muon.
But there is one dark photon. And then it makes it.
Yeah, but there's dark, but there's one normal photon, but particles have different electromagnetic charges, which say all they couple to. So you can just monkey around with that.
No, but
it makes sense with the photon.
There's one dark photon which mixes with regular photon, and we don't have regular photon couples to everything. So there's just one epsilon max. There's these other parameters, but
well, there's one epsilon, but there's lots. But this thing couples to all fermions.
So in principle, what you're saying is you could have some dark charges for these.
Different dark photons, then couple differently with different parameters.
Yeah, but then it's no longer.
That's a separate question.
It's true.
Be controlled.
It is true, but then the model that I'm considering here is just the minimal one, where I have a universal coupling. Yeah.
I mean, you could control.
In principle, you could. Yeah, you could.
Make
you could.
It work. That's all I'm saying.
You could, yeah. But for this, I just wanted to just extend the minimal dark photon model just a little bit, and then see what it does for my dark sector physics. And I mean, people have looked at supersymmetry and adding an extra U1 gauge symmetry to supersymmetry, and then you have all this whole tower of particles that you need to extend, and you have, like, you know, all this phenomenology to do. I'm looking here at just the minimal dark matter model and just extending that a little bit. And
so that's just a question on that. I mean, given what the LHC is telling us about the absence of supersymmetry, does that rule out that idea entirely for G-2 of the mu?
Carlos Wagner wrote a paper recently about this. I think what they do is that they have masses, the SUSY particle masses at larger masses, but then they have to increase their couplings as well in order to explain the G-2 value. So tan beta here has to be much larger than what you would expect.
So it could still do it.
It could still, in some sector of the SUSY model.
More contrived.
I don't want to say it's more contrived. I have no, yeah.
If it's in a big enough a space, then you can do anything.
All right, yeah.
So are there others in indirect or direct dark matter searches?
The problem with indirect detection in searches is that the Chi-2 right now you wouldn't have any Chi-2 particles that would kind of co-annihilate with these particles in order to give you indirect searches. Direct searches would be above 1 GeV. They are. So like Sensei, for instance, or Super CDMS would look for these kind of particles in the detectors. But these are like, you know, just above 1 GeV. They're current limits for these.
What is the mass that here you have? I guess I don't.
So the mass is, I'm looking at 1 GeV.
That's for A prime.
That's A prime. So the dark matter is a third of that.
A dark matter.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're saying basically the mass for dark matter is too low.
It's too low for this, yeah. Because my interest is only up until this region because of the G-2. However, like if you went larger than imprint, yeah, you could have the bonds from direct detection.
There is no direct detection experiment that's sensitive to lower mass.
This low mass, not that I know of.
Can you design one?
Other people have. I think you need very. I mean, right now Sensei looks at skipper CCDs. Like really, like people like Catherine Zurek have looked at different materials to probe these very low mass regions, and you know, yeah. So in principle, it is possible.
It's amazing. I have to make 70 years of accelerator experiments that we would not have detected a 1 GeV vector particle. That to me is amazing.
Yeah.
The universe is an amazing place.
I'm not sure what to answer for
that.
That's
amazing.
Well, how do you know?
Not sure, yeah.
That's the next question. Thank you.